What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our next guest is Lauren Helpler, an investigative reporter at Cal Matters focused on labor issues in California's housing crisis. She spent the past decade covering housing, labor, and climate issues for the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Guardian, the LA Times, and others. Her piece that we are discussing today is A Volunteer Jail Inside the Scandals and Abuse Pushing California's Homeless Out of Shelters. Emergency shelters are supposed to be safe havens, but a Cal Matters investigation finds they are deadlier than jails, and the vast majority of residents remain homeless. Good morning, Lauren.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on the show. I think this might be your first time on L&D. I have to tell you before we start, you will always be in my brain. Do you know you were the last reporter I talked to in person before I locked down for the pandemic?
I remember that morning. That was a trip. Yeah.
Right? It was the day that the ship was docking in the bay. All right, on to your story. Very disturbing stuff inside of here. At the very top of your article, Lauren, you say, and I quote, just about everywhere, a hidden epidemic of shelter death lurks, end quote. That's an intense statement. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I mean, this reporting really stems from honestly years and years of talking to people in encampments about, you know, why are you out here on the street when the state is supposed to have this network of shelters to offer, you know, what they say is a safe place to at least sleep and get meals, some of the basics to survive. And people told me they are dangerous places. Like, and so we really set out to find the paper trail of that. And like, what does that mean? And yeah, one of the most disturbing findings that to our knowledge has not been published elsewhere is that more than 2,000 people have died in California's homeless shelters. Just the publicly funded shelters, this doesn't get into privately funded institutions, from 2018 to mid last year. And just as one kind of benchmark, that's nearly twice as many people who have died in California's jails during the same period. So we're unfortunately talking about a scenario where people are dying due to many reasons. It kind of mirrors the research we've seen so far from UCSF and other places where you've got a mix of overdose deaths. There are deaths due to suicide, due to chronic health issues, a lot of heart and lung disorders. We're honestly trying to dig more into these coroner reports to understand more, but it was certainly a shocking number.
I'm going to ask you some questions that will sound similar, but I'm asking in different ways to help unpack this. First of all, there's not enough beds, right? Period. We don't have enough shelter beds. We don't have enough substance abuse beds. We don't have mental health beds, et cetera. We just do not have the facilities. So a lot of cities in California, in part at the behest of Governor Gavin Newsom right now, I have been sending people to jails, which many activists, including myself, have been angry about. But based on some of the events you detail in your article, the facts are that jails may be safer than the facilities that are in theory designed to help them. What are the inherent, I mean, we're going to get into the specifics of scandals, right, in a minute, but what are like sort of the inherent things that are broken about the shelter system that lend way to these kinds of horrific events occurring, and not just like with one provider, but many providers across the state?
Yeah, it's really that there are several things happening at once. The first is this scarcity issue you mentioned. There are still three times as many unhoused people as there are shelter beds in California. We've got about 61,000 beds versus more than 180,000 homeless residents. And what folks told me over and over is you start with this scarcity, and then you've got issues with those scarce beds being potentially really mismanaged in some cases. Audits have shown a lot of those beds aren't even being filled, even though there are long wait lists. And then once you actually talk to the people who are in these places, you just hear really jarring things. Like I think of standing on the sidewalk outside of a homeless shelter in South LA, where one woman literally still had metal staples in her head and a black eye from being beaten by another resident of the shelter. And she was introduced to me by another woman who had been stabbed by a man who lived at this shelter. And again, like we did do our due diligence to request, you know, the incident reports, the police logs to be like, we want to make sure this isn't like totally one-off instances. And we really found repeated reports about child abuse, stabbings, sexual harassment, sexual assaults across the state, unfortunately.
In addition, experts that you talk to are also saying that this over-reliance on shelters as the solution to the unhoused crisis just ain't gonna cut it. How come?
Yeah, so this is a very active area of conversation right now, but the big kind of takeaway is that the shelters as it stands, with California's housing crisis being so severe, really just become kind of like a bridge to nowhere. Even with the most favorable math, you see like about 20% of people moving from shelters to permanent housing. If you do the math in a more critical way, it's like 10% of people maybe moving on to permanent housing. And part of that is, you know, it's just so competitive for anyone who's like a working person in California to find housing. So, you know, it's not surprising that if you're in a shelter and you've maybe got like an eviction on your record or other things, that it would be hard to find your own housing on the open market. We know the wait lists for subsidized housing are years and years long in a lot of places. So that's certainly a very intense kind of logjam or backlog there. And then the other thing folks told me is just that when you look around the state at what's actually kind of more promising, we're seeing more success in a lot of cases with like direct rental assistance or ongoing income support. There have been some pilots in San Francisco and LA that showed better numbers of people either staying in housing and avoiding becoming homeless or moving off the street back into a stable setting quicker. So this is going to be a really big area to focus on. Like, does the state maybe move away from some of this triage, short-term shelter, or even like in San Francisco, they've had these like tent cities that the city funds. And do they put some more of that money into things like rent assistance or other ways to stabilize folks?
Gee, Lauren, you mean like prevention maybe could be the solution to some of this stuff?
Huh. Who knew?
What a funk. Yeah. Lauren Helpler, who is supposed to be keeping an eye on these shelters? I mean, I think as I was reading your story, I was remembering, and I can't think of the provider's name, but not too long ago, I was covering deaths of, I think it was during the pandemic, deaths of unhoused people that they were, you know, when the cities were sheltering people inside of hotel rooms and people were just mm-hmm. dropping dead. Who's supposed to be keeping an eye on what's happening?
So there's a lot of finger pointing here, but it usually comes down to whoever the funder is when we're again talking about these publicly funded shelters. So the state agencies will say, well, if the city or the county is the one funding this shelter, they should be the one keeping an eye on it. But what's complicated is that often these shelters get a whole mix of funding. Like they during the pandemic in particular, there's a lot of state money and federal money in these systems. But we found that the state and the feds aren't really following up on these things, like the deaths or the reports of unused beds or obviously the whole housing issue that's at the core of this. So it just becomes kind of blame shifting where the governor and the state say, hey, local governments, you should be on top of this. And they're like, we're overwhelmed by all of this. Like, why isn't the state doing more to support? But we have heard just in the past couple of weeks that there's going to be another state bill that would at least require more unannounced inspections of shelters and annual reports. But again, it's like, does this stuff actually make it into a government report or does it just kind of keep happening behind the scenes?
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get into some specifics. Well, first, I'll just say, you don't have to comment on this, but I did want to just point out that you do have a woman inside of your article who had actually worked in shelters, became homeless herself, fleeing violence in her home, who made a choice to sleep in her car rather than a shelter because of the conditions she had witnessed. I was like, wow.
Yeah, she said she felt safer and more dignified. Yeah,
right, in her car. All right, let's start with a provider that is not going to be unfamiliar to my listeners or the fact that they're embroiled in scandal, and that is the Bay Area Community Services, or BACS. You start with their facility, the Share Center in Salinas, but they got issues across the region, yes? What are some of the allegations and concerns about BACS?
Yeah, so we received hundreds and hundreds of internal emails about a shelter in Salinas when we asked for any complaints about homeless shelters there. And what we got back was really kind of a laundry list of allegations against BACS, everything from shelter staff committing, you know, CalFresh benefit fraud, ridiculing clients, stealing food and donations from clients, allowing their own friends and family to jump the line for housing resources or shelter beds. Really a long list of things. And I should say that BACS notes that they have not found evidence of the most severe allegations of fraud and misuse of resources. But like you say, we also received records back in Alameda County that show a number of deaths at a BAC shelter in downtown Oakland. We're actively following up on that and trying to understand more about those deaths. But it's an interesting topic because we're talking about this is a nonprofit that has seen like 1,000% revenue growth in about the last decade. The CEO has been named Woman of the Year by state lawmakers. But when you dig a little deeper, these are the types of things you can find.
Listen, and I'll just say for my listeners here, right, to just localize it to Oakland, with the violent eviction of the Wood Street encampment, one of the oldest encampments here in the city of Oakland. BAX was the housing provider, air quotes, on site. And, you know, on my other hat is as executive director, co-founder of APTP, the team that was out there trying to protect folks from the cops were taking notes from the unhoused residents. And that was the one place they did not want to go. They all had stories about this particular provider that we documented. But the city continues to be in relationship with them, which is what happens to providers across the state, apparently, regardless of whether they are successful or not successful at what they promised to do and get these multi-million dollar grants for. Lauren, let's switch to, Bridges. What shelters do they run? And then you could segue into there of your own volition to talk about the never-ending cycle of people who get kicked out of these places, the reasons why and where they go.
Yeah, I learned about Bridges through a woman named Jolene Tingler. She has an incurable brain disease called Huntington's disease. It's a genetic condition kind of similar to Parkinson's. And I met her on the street in Orange County outside of kind of a free soup kitchen. And she has physical symptoms like voice tremors. And I was kind of like, you know, if you've got these medical conditions, like, why are you outside? The day I met her, it was sweltering, like 90 something degrees. And she was just outside with nowhere to go. And she said, well, I was at this shelter, but it's like the sixth one I've gotten kicked out of. So Bridges at Kramer Place is a publicly funded shelter in Orange County in Anaheim. And what we found when we looked into it was that this is one of many shelters in the state that actually kicks out far more people than they house. So based on the nonprofit that runs it, Mercy House's own numbers, about 11% of the 400 or so people who went through Bridges last year found permanent housing, but more than eight times that many people ended up back on the street at another shelter in an unknown location or actually died. And this kind of revolving door is what we really saw across the state. Like the term that you hear a lot is exited, which is kind of like the nonprofit term for kicking people out. And what you see is that people keep churning. A lot of times I found folks who were like in a tent or in the woods right outside of a shelter after they got kicked out. Other times folks are sent to jails, hospitals, other temporary programs. So for me, it really just kind of crystallized like how self-defeating this whole thing is. Like, we put the public resources into getting someone into a shelter where hopefully, you know, they could help be stabilized and find their next move. But instead, something goes wrong. In Jolene's case, it was that she smokes weed to manage her symptoms. And it's like, well, you got to get out. We can't tell you where to go, but just figure it out. And like, of course, that's not going to work.
You highlight a bunch of stories in your very in-depth piece, Lauren. But talk to us, or Anne, talk to us about Catherine Moore.
Yeah, so Catherine is another Orange County resident. She's now 54 years old. And her story was interesting to me because it really, you know, when you talk about homelessness, a lot of times people will also talk about drugs and mental illness. And she really sat down with me and said, like, one of the biggest conceptions about all of this is that everyone becomes homeless because, oh, you know, they already have an addiction or they're just so severely mentally ill. And that was not her story at all. Like, she and her husband at the time lost jobs during the Great Recession, moved into an RV, and then they split up and she lost everything and ended up on the street. And she said it was then when she was just completely fending for herself as a woman on the street, at one point living like in a tunnel under a bridge, that she started using meth to stay up at night when rapes and robberies were really common. And so that just became kind of a years long, like, desperate scramble to survive. She ultimately got clean while she was in jail shortly after her first grandchild was born. and then moved to a city-funded shelter, though she was kind of like, what is going on here, when she got to the shelter and found out it was next door to a strip club and a freeway, like not exactly the best environment to try to get your life back together. And she said, you know, so again, this is someone who has lived in a carceral setting. She's been in jail. She came straight from jail. And she said the shelter is a volunteer jail. And the thing she said is the only difference is there are more standards and you have more rights as a person in jail. That's horrible, isn't it? And what she meant by that Whoa. Is that she found, yeah, she said she found drugs on the shelter floor again when she was newly in recovery. She had to clean bloody toilets. She was sexually harassed by the staff. She's now part of an ongoing lawsuit against several shelter operators and public agencies. So we'll see what happens there. But her case to me really just crystallized, you know, how complicated these issues are.
It's all tragic. And some of the most heart-wrenching stories are, you know, one of the biggest issues is that of sexual assault that happens at these shelters. I'm wondering if you can talk broadly about the issue of sexual assault in these facilities, and then perhaps get specific by talking about Ronald Evans in South LA.
Yeah, again, this was another one where, unfortunately, over the last 10 or so years that I've been covering homelessness in California, women had said to me repeatedly, you know, I won't go back to a shelter because I was raped. And it's, you know, once you hear that, that is a really jarring thing to think about. And again, these places that are supposed to be safe havens. So we said, okay, let's look into this, see if there are cases, you know, that have gone through the court system on this. And we found one in South LA, the same shelter I referenced earlier, by the way, where one woman was stabbed and another was beaten and left with staples in her head. At this same shelter a few years ago, there was a security guard named Ronald Evans who was hired after he had been convicted several years earlier of second degree attempted murder and robbery. The nonprofit involved there, it's an LA-based group called Hopix. They said that they didn't know about his criminal history when they hired him. But regardless, what ended up happening, according to court records, was that, you know, Evans came to work drunk and then committed 3 sex crimes against women at the shelter in a single day. One of the women confronted him in court and said, you are one of the worst type of predators. She called him a snake who devoured what little bit of existence she was holding on to. And again, it's just like when you hear that, these are people like really trying to rebuild their lives at their most vulnerable moment. And this is what you're up against.
Lauren Hopple, you've been covering this issue for a long time. And I almost feel silly asking the question, but I gotta, right? As you noted, it's not that we can't build housing, because we can. We build above market rate housing at every whip stitch possible. Market rate housing that, by the by, sits empty, right, for years on end. What's broken? What's missing aside from political will?
It's a couple things. Like, at these places that do exist, like, we know that overnight we probably will not have the, like, 200,000 or so new homes that we need to house everyone who's on the street. In the meantime, it's like, can we at least make sure these places are safe? Because the one thing folks said to me over and over again, like even a shelter operator said to me, like the shelters suck. They are very, very important for people who are severely ill. There are elderly folks in them who people told me over and over again, like they really might not survive outside on the street. So it's like, can we at least make these short-term places function a bit better? That's one point. And then in the longer term, like you say, it's just this elephant in the room of like, what are we going to do about housing? So one medium-term thing we could do is what I was talking about with the rent assistance, just try to keep folks stable, work on some prevention so that people aren't stuck in this cycle of being on the street and then you're inside briefly and then you're back on the street. From there, there's obviously, I'm sure you know all the different proposals that are out there. Like, do we need to do some type of new form of social housing, public housing, where we're just building large new structures to move people in quickly? That's been talked about. There's obviously the big voucher system that has existed for a long time, but there are issues with getting your hands on a voucher when the wait list is years long, and then B, like whether a landlord would even take your voucher. So it's a big issue. And until then, I think we're going to continue to hear about all these issues. You know, there's other stuff that the Chronicle and others have written about with like the permanent support of housing in San Francisco, too. And there are similar concerns about like safety and sanitation in those. So it's like until we can really wrap our arms around what it means to truly address the housing crisis at all income levels, this is the type of dysfunction we're going to deal with.
Lauren Hepler, I've got to leave it there. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Hope you'll come back.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.